Well, thanks, David, for the introduction. It's a pleasure for me to have the opportunity to tell you a little bit about the X-ray Frontiers program. And this will really be a talk that will attempt to introduce questions in X-ray science a little bit, and also issues about technology. What is new? Why has the situation changed so dramatically for X-ray science recently? So I'll tell you a little bit about the development of accelerator-based X-ray sources. But to get started, I should tell you what I mean by X-rays. And I'm following a definition that David Atwood from the Center for X-ray Optics at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory has been using, and I think it's very useful. So most people define soft X-rays to mean photon energies from about 300 eV. And 300 eV, that's roughly speaking the 1s binding energy in the carbon atom. So carbon 1s binding energy or ionization potential. Up to a few keV. Here another marker, the argon 1s IP is 3.2 keV. So basically photon energies that allow you to ionize carbon 1s all the way to argon 1s, that's roughly the soft X-ray regime. And then hard X-rays, and especially in the accelerator-based community, there's particular interest in the hard X-rays, that's the regime of a few keV and higher. However, higher in this case means maybe up to tens of keV, not hundreds of keV or MeV. So as far as the photon energy is concerned, it's always going to be small in comparison to the electron rest mass. So we won't have to worry too much about relativistic effects as far as the photons are concerned. Now, the hard X-ray regime is interesting because there is a useful number to remember. When you have 12.4 keV photons, then that corresponds to a wavelength of 1 angstrom. So a useful way to remember what hard X-rays are is to say this is the wavelength regime where the wavelength is comparable to interatomic distances. Right. So this is a good way to remember what hard X-rays are. Now, what makes them useful? So why are X-rays useful? And I'm not talking about medical imaging here, right? So one thing that is probably related, I guess, to medical imaging is that one has a very high penetration depth at good spatial resolution. Right? When you use electrons for imaging at high electron energies, actually even at intermediate electron energies, when you have hundreds of UV electrons, the wavelength, the de Broglie wavelength, is already in this regime, right? So in a sense, for imaging, you could argue you could use very low energy electrons and you already get high spatial resolution. The problem is only that electrons interact very strongly with matter, and it's very difficult to suppress multiple scattering. And when it's difficult to suppress multiple scattering, then it's very difficult to invert the problem, to extract the actual structure you're after. With X-rays, it's a lot easier because they don't really interact all that much with matter. So normally, you're pretty much in the single scattering limit, even for a relatively extended system. So one exploits the small absorption probability. So that one has a large penetration depth. So this is important, of course, for condensed matter systems. The other thing is because the wavelengths are really small, it's also possible to focus X-rays down to relatively small focal spot sizes. So in principle, you could imagine that this wavelength, you could possibly focus down to 1 angstrom. Now, no one has ever focused X-rays down to 1 angstrom, but people can focus X-rays down to sub 10 nanometers already. 5 or something like that nanometers is realistic. So you can potentially have, and at many labs that's already available, you have so-called X-ray nanoprobes where you can almost probe a surface like an STM. Oh, the tip is not as small as an STM tip, but you know, potentially the size of your tip could be the size of an atom. With the additional advantage that X-rays bring you, the fact that you have element specificity. You have element specificity because in a shell, binding energies, as I said here, carbon 1s, 300 eV. When you go to the next element in the periodic table, nitrogen, the 1s binding energy is already 400 eV. Right? There are large gaps between initial binding energies from one element to the next. So you have a very high element specificity when you have a tunable X-ray source. You can basically pick those initial binding energies, and you can selectively address elements in your sample, choosing carbon, choosing nitrogen, and so forth. Right. So this element specificity, so initial binding energies or ionization potentials are element specific. And as I indicated, one can have a potentially very small focus, say already sub 10 nanometers at this point in time. Maybe just a technical remark, it's not simple to build X-ray optics simply because the index of refraction is 1, and it differs from 1 at the 10 to minus 4 or 10 to minus 5 level or so. It's pretty much 1, so it's very difficult to build lenses. One way focusing is often done is with mirrors. So it's because you have an index of refraction that's actually less than 1, you get total external reflection rather than total internal reflection at grazing incidence. And so it's not that difficult to build an X-ray mirror where you exploit total external reflection, where you exploit the fact that the index of refraction is actually smaller than the index of refraction in vacuum. Right, so it's a neat trick. But to get this top sub 10 nanometers, people use other tricks using zone plates that works, but to get even below the 1 nanometer regime, no one has come up with a feasible scheme yet at this point in time, yes.
What's limiting you? Is it aberrations? Is it numerical aperture? Or is it just making something with surfaces that are lambda smooth?
Well, what's limiting you is essentially, as I say, the index of refraction is so small that, and over any given distance, you get a very tiny change in, so to speak, the propagation of your array. So if you actually, so you would have to have
something.
You can curve something, but the effect is always going to be very small. So you have to add it up. So in many of these zone play techniques, to have many of them stacked behind each other to effectively get a cooperative effect, if you want, from the entire array. But you also have to choose then your element to be very light, maybe made of beryllium to make the absorption cross-section very small, because you also don't want to lose too many of your X-rays. So with the mirrors, it's pretty easy because you have relatively small losses. Yes?
Just to say that you can curve crystals, but then you have reflection only at right angles.
Yeah.
What he says is that for reflecting at any wavelength, you need to have
Okay, let me tell you a little bit about how X-rays are used. So I'll first talk about standards, what people would call spectroscopic techniques. And so one simple technique is to look at the X-ray absorption cross-section, the one photon X-ray absorption cross-section as a function of the photon energy. X-ray absorption cross-section as a function of the photon energy. Let me call it omega. So in atomic units, H bar is with 1, just as in high energy physics as well. So the idea here is that You have here a deep core level. And then here you have possibly a bunch of discrete states, but then typically a continuum. And by choosing your X-ray photon energy to match basically this gap, again, that's an element-specific procedure, because one is really picking a specific element in the sample. One can excite this electron into one of these bound states, and this, if it's a discrete system, a discrete set of bound states, or you actually go into the ionization continuum. But the important point here is what you're doing here, you're using your X-rays to excite the electron, but then the electron probes, so to speak, the environment. So you're using the electron as a probe. You know, so to speak, where it's coming from which element, because you chose your photon energy to match a specific initial binding energy. But then you're using this electron to explore the environment in your system. And there are basically, so these are the unoccupied orbitals in the one particle picture. And so there are two techniques that are in use. One is called ZANES, for X-ray absorption near edge structure. So near edge means one chooses the photon energy to be very close to the binding energy. So the electron that's generated has a very small kinetic energy. And so in a sense, what it does is it has a large wavelength, right? Easily much longer than an angstrom. So you're not so much resolving any length scales in the Zanes region. But what you're doing this, the reason you're doing Zanes in many cases is actually to look at these discrete states. And a special example that some of you are probably aware of, if you have systems with for example, iron, and all in a magnetic system with iron, the magnetism comes from the 3D electrons. So if you're interested in the properties of the 3D electrons using X-rays, well, then you take an initial electron and you try to put it into the 3D orbitals available, right? And so you do spectroscopy as a function of the photon energy to see, so to speak, if your 3D orbitals are somehow split, shifted, or so by the chemical environment. But you're really looking at the electronic structure in that case. So a popular way to do iron spectroscopy would be to take an electron from the L shell, say a 2p electron, and then put it into 3D and use this to probe, so to speak, how the chemical environment affected 3D. This is a dipole transition, right? So it would happen in an atom. But you would do this in a soft X-ray regime, because 2p 3D is, I don't know, 700 eV or so photon energy. You can also do this as 1s 3D when you have hard X-rays. The advantage is that, again, you have a higher penetration depth, so you can go deeper in the bulk. At the harder X-rays, the disadvantage is this is not a dipole transition, right? You're changing L by 2. But first of all, it can be facilitated as an electric quadrupole transition. So it's an E2 transition, but that's not the only thing. Your chemical environment can break the inversion symmetry about your iron atom. And as soon as you break the inversion symmetry, right, then this can actually take place as a dipole transition. So only when the chemical environment is perfectly inversion symmetric is it only an E2 transition. So it can be either E2 or E1. So this would be Zanes. The other popular technique is called XAFs. There are all these acronyms out there. I'm just telling you about these things. This stands for Extended X-ray Absorption Fine Structure. What you do here is you choose your photon energy such that you're 50 eV up to several hundred eV above your threshold. The reason you want to do this is because then your outgoing photoelectron has a wavelength of an angstrom or less, and it will scatter off neighboring atoms. So if you have here your atom that absorbs the photon, and here you have neighboring atoms, then the outgoing wave will at some point be reflected from the neighboring atoms, and this modulates the X-ray absorption cross-section. So if one measures the X-ray absorption cross-section as a function of the energy, So you'll find first that as soon as your photon energy is high enough to excite that inner shell, the cross section goes up, then you go through something like this, and because of the environment, you have some light modulations on top of the atomic cross section. And it turns out when you Fourier transform these modulations, you get the interatomic distances. Right? So this is a simple tool, a purely spectroscopic tool rather than a diffraction tool, to learn something about basically near neighbor distances. And it's particularly useful if you're interested in tracking tiny changes in interatomic bond lengths. I think people have even achieved spatial resolutions of hundreds of femtometers. So very, very high distance resolution through XSAVs. You don't get that kind of resolution through a diffraction, but diffraction is, in a sense, simpler. Okay. So this is if you're measuring the cross section as a function of the photon energy. Another thing you can do is, of course, you can just do photoelectron spectroscopy. And when you do this, you typically keep the photon energy fixed, but you're looking at all the shells from which your electrons are coming. Right? So in that case, the focus is not so much on using the electron to probe the environment, but you're using the photoelectron to probe these shells. So if you think of this in a theory picture, the way many people would treat these two cases, here you would use, in principle, always a particle hole Green's function, right? You're basically making a hole, you're putting up a particle there. However, in many cases, these holes are all decoupled because of the large energy differences between different elements. So when you can make this assumption that you have basically a static hole and only the particle up there moves in a polarizable dynamical environment, then you can boil it down to a one particle Green's function. And you're looking really just at the particle, of the dynamics of that excited particle as it moves in the system. And that's how you can calculate the cross section in that approximation. However, when you're looking at photoelectron spectroscopy, you're normally looking at the one hole component of the one particle Green's function, because there you're particularly interested in, so to speak, in all the occupied levels, right? Not the ones that you reach by absorption, but the ones where you're coming from. So photoelectron spectroscopy is more the one hole component. X-ray absorption spectroscopy is more the one particle component of the one particle Green's function. Right, what else did I want to say? So with photoelectron spectroscopy, obviously you get all the inner shell binding energies just through the Einstein relation. You take the, you know, the photon energy, you measure the kinetic energy, you know the binding energy from that. So that's quite simple. Another important aspect is the following. This is not laser physics, this is inner shell physics. The cross section is normally high for the inner shells and much lower, factor of 10 or sometimes more than that, for the outer shells, which means that what you're creating is a highly excited state by kicking out an inner shell electron, by creating that hole. And that excited state will normally decay, but in a way that never takes you back to the ground state. Right? It will normally decay either by photon emission or by electron emission, and you can do spectroscopy on both, and both give you also information about the system. So one technique, therefore, would be to look at X-ray fluorescence. In X-ray fluorescence, you're looking at, basically, if you here have an occupied level, and here you have your core level, and here you have a hole, then you simply have an electron that fills the hole, right? That's all it is. But the point is, X-ray fluorescence has the advantage that because it's X-rays, they tend to come out of the bulk with very little changes in their energy. I mean, basically no change in the energy. They could be getting absorbed in the material, but they normally don't change the energy content. So X-ray fluorescence is, again, very suitable when you're looking at bulk materials. However, it depends on the element and the inner shell you're talking to, where the X-ray fluorescence is actually important. When you take a neon atom, right, which is just a little heavier than carbon, in a neon atom, a 1s vacancy will decay by X-ray fluorescence in only 2% of all cases. 98% of all cases, it will do Auger decay. And that's what's the most important inner shell decay mechanism for all light elements. So basically, in the Auger case, maybe I'll show it over here. In the Auger case, you have here your hole, And here you have your continuum, and here's some states. Then one electron fills the hole, but the electrons can talk to each other, right? You have Coulomb-Coulomb, you have electron-electron interaction matrix elements, so that energy can be transferred and an electron can go into the continuum. For something like carbon or so, you're producing maybe electrons in the region of 200 eV. That's not very high energy electrons, and that's why these electrons will normally not be able to come out of the bulk. Right? They will only be able to emerge from a surface. So Auger electron spectroscopy is therefore normally a technique that you apply for surface studies. Or you can use it, of course, in the gas phase. I should probably say many people here in the X-ray Frontiers program are interested in AMO type, atomic molecular and optical physics type problems. So it's often, there's a strong focus often on gas phase issues. But I'm trying to point out here that many people who are interested in X-rays are more from the condensed matter community than from the AMO community, because you're really exploiting the fact that you can look at condensed matter systems in a way that you can often not with other probes. I should say that whenever you're using any such spectroscopic technique, maybe except for XFs, within the simple model that just taking, so to speak, the atomic cross-section out, and then you're just Fourier transforming it, and you get interatomic distances, that seems very simple. But for example, in the A, this is an approximation that it works so simply, and B, in many cases, especially when you're close to the edge, that just doesn't work at all. Often you look at those spectra and you have no clue what you're seeing. Right? So that's why, especially for the spectroscopic techniques, it's true that without theory, this is a pretty hopeless mess. You know which element you're exciting, but you're not necessarily have any clue what your spectrum actually means, what it tells you, so to speak, about the chemical changes. You know there is sensitivity to the chemical changes, but to interpret them, you need to have an actual theory. Similarly for photoelectron spectroscopy. In photoelectron spectroscopy, there is an approximation that many of you have heard, Koopman's theorem, which basically says if you use canonical Hartree-Fock orbitals to describe your system, then the orbital energies give you good approximations to the binding energies. This is actually exact within perturbation theory through first order. The canonical Hartree-Fock orbitals gives you the only mean field definition where this is correct through first order. For any other mean field, it's only correct through zeroth order, which is trivial. Nevertheless, there are many systems where in photoelectron spectroscopy you see way more more photoelectron lines than you have orbitals, right? Whenever that is the case, you immediately know, gosh, this is a system where you have strong interactions where one particle picture fails. So there's a lot of interest, especially in connection with photoelectron spectroscopy, in many body effects in the photoionization process. But this is R1 photon physics I'm talking about. Okay, then the standard scattering technique is elastic X-ray scattering. And X-ray people would call that coherent scattering. And in X-ray scattering, you really try to basically use a diffraction effect to learn something about structure. The focus is there much more on where do the atoms sit than on the electronic structure, whereas all these spectroscopic techniques give you mostly information about the properties of the electronic structure of your system. In diffraction, the focus is more on, where do the atoms sit in the sample. I call it the standard scattering technique because there are, of course, also non-standard techniques. There's a lot of interest these days in inelastic X-ray scattering. And inelastic X-ray scattering provides information, in a sense, about spatial properties. But it's a combination of scattering and spectroscopy, if you want. But I'm not going to talk about that because it's not as widely used yet. So this is really just elastic X-ray scattering. When we experimentally, you will hear lots of different further acronyms that they use for these kinds of things. Sometimes you'll hear things such as SACS for small angle X-ray scattering. sometimes you hear wax for wide-angle X-ray scattering. They do that in solution and crystals, and every time they have a different name for it. It's always the same thing, right? It's elastic X-ray scattering. And if your energy is high, your photon energy is high in comparison to all the ionization potentials in your system, then you can make an approximation to calculate this. One can calculate this exclusively in terms of what people call A squared. And you all know where that comes from, right? You do minimal coupling, you have something like a P minus E over C vector potential squared over 2. And when you square that, eventually you get an A squared term. Now, the A squared term in the dipole approximation is a constant. So a constant doesn't introduce any transitions or anything. But A squared in the X-ray domain, we're talking about relatively high photon momenta, right? So that the dipole approximation is actually not applicable. And to get the correct relationship between the scattering pattern and the structure of the object, you have to go way beyond the dipole approximation. You have to treat it completely without making the dipole approximation. But it basically, this A squared gives you the entire elastic scattering process. You have kind of, say, the electronic ground state you're starting from, and then you have this point-like vertex, and the photon comes out. And elastic scattering here simply means that electronically we're staying in the ground state, right? I should also say, because I think I tried to indicate it earlier, because we are working at relatively low photon energies, unless we have to worry about any relativistic effects in the electronic system itself, because we're dealing possibly with relatively heavy elements or something like that. Normally, as far as the interaction between the radiation and the electrons is concerned, we treat this entirely non-relativistically. And you know, we use the Coulomb gauge, minimal coupling, and then we get a P dot A interaction and an A squared interaction. And my statement is that A squared at high energies, I mean at least higher than all the ionization potentials, and if you have a protein, your ionization potentials are all way below a keV. So that means with hard X-rays, this approximation is always valid, right? It's just the A squared interaction. So if you have then, with the A squared, also a perfectly a perfect first order coherence, I should say. And I'm not going to define what that means, that's just for the experts. But if you have perfect first order coherence, then the cross section, the differential cross section, is just the integral over the one electron density e to the I q dot x squared. But that's just the expectation value of the electron density operator. Right? So this is, so to speak, rigorous. We did not make the dipole approximation. What is Q, I should say? Q, if this is the direction of your incoming photons, this is the incoming photon momentum, and here is your object. And here you have a detector. And then photons get detected, say, with this outgoing momentum, right? Then Q is just the difference between K in and K out, just the momentum transfer. So if we had made the dipole approximation, if we had treated the A squared operator as a constant, this here would be zero. So the scattering pattern would have no Q dependence, right? Your entire pattern is, so to speak, just the number of electrons, if you want, because this would be just the integral over the density to get just the number of electrons. So it's the fact that we went essentially correctly way beyond the dipole approximation, that we correctly include the retardation, if you want, of the vector potential. That's where the Fourier transform comes from. Now, here's a problem. You would say, if you didn't have these magnitude bars here, then you would measure your cross section as a function of Q, then you apply a Fourier transform, you get rho of x back. But that's not what we have. What we have is the modulus squared of this Fourier transform. And this is another place where theory comes in, and this is also something that, people in the program are interested in, what is called phase retrieval. How do you reconstruct the phase of this object? You have just its modulus. How do you reconstruct the phase? Because once you have the phase of this Fourier transform, then you can actually invert it, and you can get rho of x back. And there are lots of issues when it comes to noise. How does noise affect the invertibility of this? How many points in Q space do you need to be able to invert this? For example, there's a very kind of an interesting claim that tells us that if you take a two-dimensional subset of the Q space, say on a curved surface, that it's possible to get the three-dimensional rho of x back. I mean, the rho of x in three-dimensional space. That, so to speak, that two-dimensional information is already sufficient. It's a claim that has been published in Nature, I think, this year. It's called ankylography, and it's a cute idea because it seems impossible, but anyways.
Is that how it works? How it's supposed to work?
Well, I should say all these phase retrieval techniques are based on the idea that rho of x is not arbitrary. It has to, it's for example, never negative. For a finite object, you know that it's within what people call a finite support. So there are a couple of boundary conditions that provide a lot of additional information beyond simply saying you have the full Q space information. It's also related to the fact that when you look at this Q vector here, for very small scattering angles, the Q vector is just in this detector plane, up or to the side. So you have only two-dimensional information. You get effectively a two-dimensional projection of the electron density. However, for larger scattering angles, it's easy to see that Q actually has a component in this direction. Right? So you effectively have depth information in a single scattering pattern, so to speak, both transverse and longitudinal information in that single scattering pattern. And that gives you this curved surface, this curved slice through Q space that one can try to invert if one exploits additional assumptions about the properties of rho of x. But that this can rigorously be inverted has not been shown, and it's more a numerical demonstration, I would argue, at this point than anything else.
I'm not sure you're getting the density-density correlation function, as function of distance, which is putting that out of this.
No, I mean, what I'm talking about here is really just the one electron density. It's not so much a correlation function. It's just
that's the Fourier transform, the density-density correlation.
The density?
That's what the phasing does for you. Phasing allows you to go beyond the density-density correlation.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. What this is really just an autocorrelation function if you Fourier transform it. But that is fine, but most people, if they want to know where the atoms sit, they don't want to have the autocorrelation function. They want to have rho of x. And that's exactly the purpose of the phasing. That's
every rho of x will give you the correct correlation function. So there is some information in it.
Yeah. But, I mean, I know. In principle, the autocorrelation function is not necessarily sufficiently restrictive.
It's a lot of information.
Yeah, but it's normally not sufficient information, just the autocorrelation function for many purposes. If you, say you have a protein, if you want to know the functional properties of the protein, are you happy with just knowing the autocorrelation function? Or do you actually want to know, so to speak, what the actual structure rho of x is? And that's kind of the thing also in what the purpose of crystallography is still. People do crystallography because they actually want to know where the atoms sit in the unit cell. So it's the actual rho of x. Even though I say we use it to determine structure, it's always the electron density. And the assumption is, of course, where the electron density is high, that's where the atoms sit. Right. It's not like neutron scattering. When it's not looking at the nuclei, but it's still an indirect tool to determine atomic positions in space. Okay, so time is moving fast. I'm moving very slowly. I'm sorry. So there are a couple of issues that, in a sense, limited X-ray science in the past. One of them is related to the limited coherence of X-ray sources. So I'm coming now basically to the themes of the program, coherence and ultra-fast and ultra-intense. And coherence was an issue, let me call this problems, in a sense, limitations of the past. So when it came to coherence, if you have an extended object, say a virus, and your coherence length, especially your transverse coherence length, is smaller than your virus, then in a sense your wavefront is not coherently scattering from the object, and it's actually not possible to invert this. As I say, you needed to have perfect first order coherence. That's what optics people normally mean by coherence, it's just the property of the first order coherence. That means if you want to illuminate a relatively big object coherently with a well-defined phase across the wavefront, then what most people will do is they will put a pinhole in front of their X-ray source and effectively throw away most of the photons to make, so to speak, the source of the X-rays very small, and then you can coherently illuminate your object, but you have a very low flux. So this is still hard. You can do that at the very high brightness X-ray sources in the world, but it's not a standard experiment you can do, actually, for bigger objects to have good coherent illumination at high flux. So not perfectly coherent. So this refers to the sources. Then also, the intensities were always very low. So the question of whether you could have multiphoton absorption, that doesn't mean it's nonlinear, but at least several photons absorbed in a pulse by a given object, that probability was always very small. Even if you go to the APS and you take an element such as krypton and you're asking what's the probability that any given pulse will ionize a 1s electron in that atom, you'll find the probability somewhere around 10 to minus 8 or so. You can imagine that it's very unlikely that a second photon will ionize a second electron in that system. It's just 10 to minus 16, right? It's just extremely improbable. Not that Peter would say, yes, it can happen, but it's just very improbable, right? And so that's why nonlinear or multiphoton processes, in this sense, have never been observed at synchrotrons, because that the probability was just, for all practical purposes, zero. So it was always linear in A squared, or first or second order in P dot A. What I mean by that is first order in P dot A would be, for example, absorption, you just photoionize something, and second order if you have, for example, a P dot A contribution to scattering, right? Go through a series of intermediate states, go up, you absorb, you re-emit. So that would be second order in P dot A. All real photons, all photons that are actually provided by the beam, right? So that's the standard in X-ray physics so far. And one is limited, let me call it not ultra fast, one is limited by modern synchrotrons, you're limited to pulse durations of about 100 picoseconds. So anything that's faster in most molecular dynamics, unless you're looking at relatively large groups moving relative to one another, if you're looking at, so to speak, atomic motions, actual chemical dynamics, you can't see it at a synchrotron. It's just way too fast because you're limited by these 100 picosecond pulses or so. It's too slow for that purpose. There are techniques nowadays, even at synchrotrons, to make the pulses shorter. But you do that by basically throwing away most of the photons, right? So you're not compressing the pulse, you're just taking a slice out of the pulse. And at the ALS, for example, they have, at the Advanced Light Source in Berkeley, they have the possibility to create about 100 femtosecond pulses. And in each pulse, you get a few photons. So some experimentalists would joke that they can give individual names to the photons in the pulse because there are so few. So it's very hard to do some experiments where the cross sections are small. So ultrafast was not really so much an option in X-ray science. Until very recently, and this brings me to a very brief history of accelerator-based X-ray sources. Well, accelerator-based sources are synchrotron radiation sources. And so the question is, are all synchrotron radiation sources synchrotrons? Any opinions? Actually, not one of the modern X-ray sources, any of the synchrotron radiation sources is a synchrotron. They're all electron storage rings, which makes a technical difference. So they're synchrotron radiation sources are electron storage rings nowadays, and have been for decades, I should say.
But some of them positron storage rings.
Yes, electrons are anti-electrons. That's right. For example, the APS was initially a positron storage ring, but and because they thought they could avoid some...
Photon factor is still is in Japan.
Right, but it's not necessary. I mean, one can get very good vacuum. I mean, that was mostly a question of whether they have losses through... it's a question of vacuum quality and all these things. But yes, it could be electrons or positrons, you're right. But storage ring, the emphasis on storage ring rather than on the electron. Yeah. But it should be, okay. Okay, good point. So this brief history is that this business of using X-rays from accelerator-based sources for, you know, material science and stuff like that started with what people nowadays call the first generation. So that was in the 1960s, 1970s. They were operating in a so-called parasitic mode. That means these storage rings were actually really built for high energy physics or particle physics and not actually to do material science. And then some crazy material people came and thought, why not use the X-rays, right? So that's the parasitic mode or parasitic operation. But that was the early days. Then, because the people who used X-rays were really happy with them and thought it would be great to really have sources just for this purpose, they built the second generation that was in the 1980s. And so these are dedicated sources. Now, what these two generations have in common is the following. They're using bending magnet radiation. What does that mean? To have a ring, right, these are ring-like storage rings, that's why it's a ring, right? And then you have dipole magnets, north, south, and so forth, to basically keep the electrons on a circular path. And as these electrons enter the dipole magnet and make this kind of trajectory, they emit radiation like this. But I want my radiation there. That's where my sample is. So you're basically throwing away a lot of your flux when you're using the bending magnet radiation, because your sample is here and you have basically radiation in all these directions, right? So that's inconvenient. The other thing is it's also relatively broadband. So you would have to put in a monochromator and you're throwing away even more of your flux. So you end up again with just a couple of photons at your sample, so to speak. So that's when the third generation came. The third generation that started in the 1990s, but it's still ongoing. I should mention, for example, that very recently, the world's brightest third generation source was inaugurated at DESY, Petra 3. So this is still something that people are interested in these third generation sources. But the brightest hard X-ray source in the Western Hemisphere, emphasis on Western Hemisphere, is actually the advanced photon source at Argonne, right, here in the US. Now, what makes these third generation sources so special? Well, they don't normally use the bending magnet radiation, even though you can have beamlines where you can use the bending magnet radiation, because you get it for free, right? You have the bending magnets anyway, so you can use the radiation as well. But what makes them special is this idea of using an insertion device. That means you have linear stretches where the electrons move basically linearly. And when you look at this from the side, you have basically a periodic array of dipole magnets, but it's an alternating array. So it would be north-south, south-north, and so forth. So when the electrons enter the undulator, they get moved a little bit to the left, and then to the right, and to the left, and to the right. So when you're looking here, here you're the observer. So then you're seeing basically an electron bunch that wiggles like this, right, left and right. So it looks a little bit like a Hertz dipole. But it's a straight section. So all the radiation, if you don't make the electrons wiggle too much, then all the radiation is peaked in the forward direction. Basically, the opening angle here of the radiation goes as 1 over gamma, where gamma is the usual 1 over square root of 1 minus beta squared, right? So in other words, when you have a gamma of 10 to the 4 or so, then this opening angle is of the order of 10 to minus 4. So you get a nicely focused beam. Now, this also gives you an idea what the wavelength is. So what I'm describing here is the principle of an undulator, right? An insertion device, which characterizes third generation sources. If the undulator period is of the order of a centimeter, that's normally the case. 1 centimeter. Then in the reference frame of the electrons, the undulator period that they see is lambda u over gamma, because it's length contracted. So in their own reference frame, they emit at a wavelength of lambda u over gamma. But the observer sees this blue shifted because of the Doppler effect. So that comes in another factor of 1 over gamma. So the lambda that the observer actually sees is of the order of the undulated period over gamma squared. So if you have a gamma of the order of 10 to the fourth, which you get when you have an accelerator source, when you have electrons basically at several GeV, then you get into this regime of gamma of 10 to the fourth. And you know, at the APS you have that, and at all the big energy facilities you have that. With a gamma of 10 to the fourth, a lambda u of a centimeter, this lambda u over gamma squared is an angstrom, right? So yeah, I can just say it in words. So basically, because of gamma and because of the undulated period, what comes out here is already in the hard X-ray domain, right? I mean, you can tune it to some degree, obviously, by changing gamma. There is also another way to tune it by changing the gap. That has a smaller impact. I mean, this is still the leading order expression, but there's a little bit of dependence on the gap between these two magnets. And so one has control over the properties of the radiation. It's much less broadband. I mean, it's not monochromatic, but it's very different from bending magnet radiation, which looks pretty much like white light. Undulator radiation is spectrally a lot more narrow, basically defined by this relationship. OK, so this brings me now to the fourth generation, and this, in a sense, the solution of all the problems of the past, if you want. The idea of the fourth generation sources, maybe I'll use some space over here, is to basically take the idea of using an undulator to the extreme. And what I mean by that is the following. When you think of the way the electrons emit radiation in the undulator, they're all emitting independently, right? You're starting with some unstructured electron bunch. I mean, it might have a well-defined overall shape, but the positions of the electrons in the electron bunch, they're completely random as they enter the undulator. So there are no special phase relationships between the waves that get emitted by the individual electrons. And that means the radiation, that into the intensity that comes out here, let me call it I for intensity for a third generation source, is proportional to the number of electrons in the electron bunch. There are no cooperative effects. The idea then for the fourth generation sources, for the free electron lasers, is to exploit cooperative effects. What you're essentially doing is you're making the undulator so long that the electrons can bathe in their own synchrotron radiation. And then there is an instability for the electron bunch to undergo microbunching. I don't think that's entirely trivial to see, so I'm not going to try to explain it. But the point is, when if one looks at the fields that the electrons see, the electron-electron Coulomb repulsion, they see, so to speak, the field from the magnet that gets transformed to something more complicated in their own reference frame, plus the field from the spontaneously emitted synchrotron radiation. Right? So at the beginning of the undulator, they have the spontaneously emitted synchrotron radiation, but they move in their own radiation. The electrons move essentially at the speed of light. There's a little bit of slippage between the two, but essentially the electrons move with their own radiation, and that radiation acts back on the electrons. So what one finds in the long undulator, this is the fourth generation, the X-ray-free electron lasers. So what one finds essentially for a long undulator, and in practice nowadays, there are, you know, a few hundred meters long or so. So the number of undulator periods would be of the order of 10 to the fourth or something like that. And so again, you imagine that this is periodically structured. And you start here with your electron bunch with random positions. And as the electrons move through the undulator, at some point, this starts to undergo microbunching, and such that in their own reference frame, the electrons in the microbunch are within a wavelength of the radiation in their own reference frame. In their own reference frame, we're talking about microns or so, right? Not the angstroms. Right, this is a centimeter over gamma in their own reference frame. So in their own reference frame, they basically sit together, these electrons, within a wavelength. And because of that, they all emit in phase. So the radiation emitted from a microbunch is proportional to the number of electrons squared, where this is now the number of electrons in a microbunch. That's why you get exponential gain in such a free electron laser. So at the beginning of the undulator, you have emission that's proportional to the number of electrons. Then as the electrons travel through the undulator, the electron bunch undergoes restructuring, and suddenly you get this quadratic increase. And if you have, I don't know, a million electrons or so in a microbunch, or you know, some large number, then the increase in intensity is dramatic. Right? It's that instability that is used. So this principle here is what underlies all X-ray-free electron lasers. It's called SASE, for self-amplified spontaneous emission. And this has important consequences for the properties of the radiation. The transverse properties are pretty well defined. So you get in the fourth generation source a relatively well-defined transverse phase. So the transverse coherence is fairly good. But because of the way the microbunching occurs, that changes from shot to shot, right? It's completely, so to speak, seeded by its own shot noise. And that means longitudinally, your pulses that come out will look like this. You know, they will, I mean, you could argue there's overall an envelope. And the average envelope might be well defined, but the individual shots will look all different. Yeah, we'll have different shapes. And for LCLS, the duration of such a spike is of the order of a femtosecond or hundreds of attoseconds. So I already used the word, even though I didn't introduce it. So LCLS is actually the very first X-ray free electron laser, LCLS. This stands for the LINAC coherent light source. And this, many of you may have heard this. So this saw first lasing in April 2009. It's at SLAC, what nowadays may not be called Stanford Linear Accelerator Laboratory anymore, but is now the SLAC National Accelerator Lab. Stanford is out of the picture. So SLAC, LCLS at SLAC. And so first lasing in 2009, in April 2009, and also the first user experiments started then in 2009. Actually, they started in October. So to some degree, a main purpose, at least from my perspective, of the X-ray Frontiers program is to talk about experiments that were done at LCLS in the first round, and also opportunities for future experiments. things that are enabled by A, the high degree of coherence, at least the transverse degree of coherence, things that are enabled by the high intensity, and I'll try to give you an idea how high the intensity is, and the fact that the pulses are short. So let me just give you that, and then I think I should wrap up.
Robin, you might mention that the first SASE FEL actually was operating humble, right?
Yeah, but not the first X-ray FEL.
But according to this principle.
Yeah, that's right. So that's true. The very first SASE FEL was at that time called the.
You're actually employed there, so you might want to mention that.
Yeah, but it's not. But you see, that I started with my definition of X-rays, and it's outside the scope of this talk.
I see.
That's why I talked about Petra 3. I had to bring in something about Daisy, right? But anyways, so let me tell you a little bit about the properties of these sources, and let's compare the APS, which, as I told you, is an extremely bright hard X-ray source, the brightest in the Western Hemisphere here in the US, and let's compare that with the LCLS in terms of pulse duration. So here you have a typical pulse duration of 100 picoseconds at LCLS. It can go all the way down to 1 femtosecond. Up to a few hundred femtoseconds. And there's some ability to actually tune the pulse duration at LCLS. So this brings you, so to speak, in the ultra-fast domain, right? The really short pulses. Then the number of photons in a pulse. Now I should also say in what bandwidth, so in a bandwidth of about an eV, that would be of the order of 10 to the 6th at the APS, and at the LCLS, it would be somewhere between 10 to the 10 and 10 to the 12 photons, where the 10 to the 10 here refers to the short pulse, because the shortest pulses at LCLS are, again, not produced by bunch compression, but by a kind of a slicing scheme where you're throwing away photons, effectively. That's why the shorter pulses at LCLS correspond to fewer photons, whereas if you're going to, say, from a few hundred femtoseconds to, I don't know, 50 or 40 femtoseconds, you can do that at LCLS with the same number of photons. So they have, to some degree, the ability to compress, and at some point, the ability to throw away photons to get even shorter pulses. Now, if we combine these two, we can define something like a peak. Let me call it power. The number of photons, it's not exactly an energy per unit time, but the number of photons per unit time. So here you get 10 photons in a femtosecond. And here, for LCLS, you get 10 to the 10 photons per femtosecond. So this is now a case where when you go from the third generation to the fourth generation, we're not talking about an increase by an order of magnitude. We're talking about an increase in the peak intensity by 9 orders of magnitude when going from the APS to the LCLS. So it's an enormous boost. But I should also say the average flux, so to speak, if you average over many shots, that's not all that different. It's a little bit higher maybe at LCLS than at the APS, but not a lot. The reason for this is, here at the LCLS, they're running at a repetition rate of about 100 hertz, about 100 shots per second, and here they're running at 6.5 megahertz. So you get way more shots per second. But if you're interested in making use of the short pulse duration and the high intensity, it's this number that counts, this increase by 9 orders of magnitude, which is really dramatic. So I guess with this, I would just like to say, or repeat what the purpose is, therefore, of our program. That these new sources, these SASE sources, especially in the X-ray domain, FELs have been around at longer wavelengths for a long time than the first SASE FEL, as Jan-Michael pointed out, was the one in Hamburg. But now the first X-ray, especially hard X-ray FEL in the world, started operation in 2009. And it has this possibility to provide basically perfect transverse coherence, very short pulses, very high intensity. So we can look, for example, at the question of whether it is possible, and this was kind of the poster child for LCLS. The question is whether you can actually now start to image objects such as membrane proteins that could not be imaged before. The challenge was, still is, that to do crystallography at a source such as the APS, you need a crystal. And many of these proteins are fairly floppy, and so they don't actually like forming crystals, and so you can't use crystallography. So an idea here at LCLS is the possibility to use single molecules, and you let them drop into the beam, you take a single shot pattern, and you try to extract the structure from a single shot. That will be noisy, so you will have to compare lots of patterns. Yeah, that will be noisy, right? So you will have to take all these noisy patterns. You have to find a way to compare the noisy pattern from this object to the noisy pattern from this orientation of the object. The structure could be a little bit different because these objects are a little bit floppy. So there are issues, right? Basically, from these single shots, you're able to collect the number of photons, but because the absorption cross-section is still higher than the scattering cross-section, you're also completely destroying the molecule during the shot. And that destruction of the molecule during the shot also has to be understood. It will have to enter in one way or another in the modeling, and there's interest also in our community in trying to see how this can be improved, arguments why the problems may not be as bad as one might naively think, and things like that. The high intensity means we can now look at processes beyond first order perturbation theory or leading order perturbation theory, whether it's absorption or scattering. We can look at new mechanisms that could possibly be of interest in the X-ray domain at high intensity, things that could not be studied before. Possibly new spectroscopic techniques. I don't know. We'll have to explore this. And then finally, the possibility to use X-rays with high spatial resolution. Right? The difference between laser science, where ultrafast has been around for a long time, in ultrafast laser science, people are now trying to look at imaging of objects in a time-resolved manner. But it's all, in a sense, limited to small objects. It's not clear that bigger objects would be able to stand the intensity, whether or not several electrons would be launched for imaging with a laser. Normally, in ultrafast laser physics, the focus was more on seeing that something changes as a function of time, but not so much seeing what changes, just seeing that it changes as a function of a time delay. So one had high temporal resolution. Now with the FEL, because you have, for example, the ability to do diffraction with a short pulse, you have the ability to look at very short time domains, but also look with high resolution in the spatial domain, so to speak, seeing atoms move and things like that. There are interesting challenges, for example, for looking at nuclear dynamics. That means the motion of the atomic nuclei. That's what people in our community mean by nuclear dynamics. When the Born-Oppenheimer approximation fails, and there are many cases in chemical dynamics, in photochemistry and so forth, where it's well known that the Born-Oppenheimer approximation is just plain wrong, where you have very strong coupling between various electronic potential energy surfaces, and seeing how that can be exploited using a source such as LCLS, how one could study such processes in real space, in real time, with such a source. This is another of the challenges. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. So what would be the parameters of the new FEL that's being built at DAISY?
Oh, the one at DAISY. Okay, so the one at DAISY, this is mostly a technical difference, and the point is that to use the existing accelerator structure at LCLS, which is based on non-superconducting copper-type cavities, that limits them to these 100 hertz repetition rates. They're not able to feed too many electron bunches into the accelerator. At the DAISY, it's going to be an entirely superconducting structure. So it's possible to add more electron bunches, so they will be able to operate at about 10 kilohertz repetition rate. So the average number of photons is going to be way higher than at LCLS. And even the number of photons per shot is going to be a little bit higher, but not a lot higher. Also, the highest energy in the fundamental at LCLS is 8 keV. And at the XFL and DAISY, it's going to be about 12 kV. So it's going to take us to that one angstrom. So it's 1.5 versus one angstrom. I mean, that difference is not a very large one. But the average flux is going to be way higher at the XFL in Hamburg.
Robin, you mentioned at the beginning that these X-rays can be focused to 10 nanometers.
Less.
And just at the end, you mentioned that a goal might be to hit a single large protein, which is also of the order of 10 nanometers. Currently, how controllable is it to have single molecules go into such a tight focus?
It's going to be not going to be a 10 nanometer focus. It's probably going to be a 100 nanometer focus. So the question is, to what degree can you guide the molecules to that 100 nanometer region? And I would say, I don't know. I think that's an experimental challenge. What has been done at LCLS so far was with a 1 micron focus and a stream of nanocrystals of some biological molecule called photosystem 1, I think. So they had nanocrystals with maybe 10 molecules per edge, you know, so like 1,000 molecules in the entire nanocrystal. And so the stream, I don't know how wide it was, but this was water with the nanocrystals in them. And I think that was actually a lot wider than the X-ray beam. I would guess a millimeter or something like that. So they tried to hit them the stream at some point, and they just tried to see whether it lights up at some point in this way, because the ionize at that point where the beam hits the stream of this water stream. And in this way, they overlapped it. Now, I would say it depended a lot on the fact that that the concentration of the nanocrystals probably had to be reasonable. I mean, if you have a terribly small concentration, this would not work. But I think they had a hit rate of about 50%, if I'm not mistaken. So it was not very small, not for that experiment. But that was a 1 micron focus, right? 100 nanometers is you could easily then think that you lose at least a factor of 10.
The point is, if you try to go to single particles going through the beam, the hit rate just goes down, and you may have...
Yeah, it will go down.
50% per single particle. Yeah. So they only had one single particle beam at a time.
Yeah, it was 50%. Yeah.
Outside the program.
At some point, you were saying that the A square term can dominate over P dot A term. But if the A square is the two photon process, you have to absorb two photons in one go, and the intensity is low, as you were saying. So,
essentially, you're taking a photon out of the mode where you have lots of photons in there, and then you're taking a photon into a mode that was initially unoccupied. So overall, the probability is still linear in the intensity of the incoming beam. The same as if you're doing P dot A second order, right? You're taking out one photon of the incoming beam and you're putting it into another mode. So it's different if you're asking, what's the probability to absorb first one photon from that mode and then absorbing another photon from that mode. Right, so A squared, you can have an A dagger A, say with one mode and another mode. You can have an AA, or an A, you can have an A dagger, you can have an AA, right? So this is the one, the AA, which would take out two photons of the incoming mode, and then the probability would go quadratically with intensity. For scattering, if you take out one photon from the incoming mode and you're putting a photon into a previously unoccupied mode, it's still linear in the incoming intensity. So it's not a problem.
How many electrons are in such a micro bunch, actually?
I'm not sure. It's macroscopic in the sense that you get an increase in the emitted radiation intensity by many, many orders of magnitude, which means that if you initially had an intensity here that's proportional to NE, and then here when you have a microbunch, it goes up as NE squared, where NE is the number of electrons in the microbunch. If you gain many, many orders of magnitude, you have to have at least 1,000 or something like that, 10 to the 4 electrons per microbunch. But the exact number, I'm not sure. Do you know?
Well, I think the whole bunch structure is in the range from nano to picocoulomb. So probably it's nanocoulomb, a single bunch.
You mean a microbunch?
In a microbunch, yeah.
So that's a very large number then. Right?
Presumably it increases as you move along, it gets ME grows.
Right. So essentially, if you plot the power, you're right, the number of electrons that, so to speak, enter up in a microbunch goes up. And so the power would then, on the logarithmic scale, log of the power would then go up like this. So you really have exponential increase. And at some point, once the electron bunches have gone as much structuring as they can, then that's it, right? Then it will saturate. And then there's basically no point in making the undulator a lot longer than what you need to saturate this.
And if you comb them, just selected one microbunch, you get a coherence in the longitudinal direction as well.
If you could select the microbunch, yeah. If you have a way to introduce a temporal slit, so to speak, yeah, yeah. I mean, there are ideas to, in a sense, instead of letting the seed itself from spontaneous emission, one can try to seed it with a low intensity but well-defined pulse, and then make only that well-defined part lays, and then you would get a much better defined pulse out, not something like this, right?
Another question is about this accelerate, this technique. Is there any limitation? You're probably not interested in gamma rays, but is there any limitation in going up in energy, pulse duration, down?
I would think that depends on what electron energies you can get in that.
Yeah, well, that's sort of build out a large and then a
smaller. I mean, the physics, I guess, of the way the undulation works is similar. What I'm not sure is whether a 100-meter undulator will still be enough. But I would think I would think there's nothing in the physics of this that would limit one to this X-ray regime. I think one can go higher as long as the basic description remains valid. I don't see why it should fail.
Does delta E, delta T cause you any problems when you decrease the duration?
You're asking whether these are Fourier limited pulses? Basically, the bandwidth of your pulses is defined by this duration, not by the full pulse duration. Sure. So in other words, this is in a regime where your delta E is still, you know, much, let me put it like this. If you have a 1 eV bandwidth, you could still make your pulse a factor of 100 or so shorter and take just one of these spikes, and you would still have the same bandwidth. Right? In other words, this is not Fourier limited in any way. And you see, this is a pulse duration of a femtosecond or so, if you really had that one spike, that's a bandwidth of about an eV, roughly speaking. So that's where your Fourier limitation would come in. Once you're asking about sub-femtosecond pulses, if you want to generate, say, 100 attosecond pulses, you have to live with the bandwidth of 10 eV. But we're not there, even though people are talking about implementing attosecond technology even at an FEL.
Okay, let's thank Robin again.